This is the first time you're speaking publicly.
I had no need to talk to the media. They were looking for sensationalism, and they were looking for the monster.
Police found 29 bodies buried in shallow graves under Gacy's suburban Chicago home.
It had nothing to do with the bodies. The dead won't bother you. It's the living you got to worry about.
Welcome back. Well, this month, a six-part docuseries was released, John Wayne Gacy, Devil in Disguise. You just heard a little bit of it. It's one of the best and most comprehensive pieces about one of the world's most notorious serial killers who lived here in Illinois, in Norwood Park. He was arrested in 1978. And with us to talk about Devil in Disguise is the executive producer, Tracy Ullman. Hi, Tracy. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Karen, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, Tracy, you and I have known each other and been talking to each other for many years. I want to say nine or so years. You've been working on this.
It took us 10 years.
10 years.
To put it together, and I think I called you fairly quickly on because we needed the knowledge that you had about the case.
And just for people who don't know, I represented John Gacy in the final set of his death row appeals for the last 7 months of his life. Most of my efforts were to, not get him out of jail, but to save his life and not have him be executed. But spoiler alert, he was executed May 10th, 1994. So, Tracy, what was the interest in, you know, there have been so many made for TV, so many books, so many even just dramatizations. What made you focus on this case that's been covered over and over again?
The reason we devoted time to it, I was originally called by Allison True from the Chicago Reader. She had had a story come across her desk that didn't look at the case of kind of this exploitative serial killer and all of the boogeyman aspects of it. But she was looking at it from a perspective of, you know, Chicago politics and potentially corruption that would have been in and around Gacy's sphere. And that really intrigued me. It was never, you know, this kind of, boogeyman. It was always, you know, what was going on around John Wayne Gacy that he might have been facilitated. And that was very intriguing. And that, I think, caught the attention of a lot of people that we ended up, you know, calling up and asking if they'd participate.
You know, and again, I think a lot of listeners and a lot of people over the years who have spoken to me about these issues say, well, you know, we don't care. He killed 33 boys. What else do we need to know? But I think one of the things that this docuseries really talks about is why didn't he get caught sooner? And you can explain it away by a lot of things. It was the time. There was no national database. But can you, Tracy, just talk a little bit about some of the aspects of this that make you scratch your head and say, why in the world wasn't he caught sooner?
And so a lot of these records were coming out of areas 5 and 6 within the city of Chicago. And cops talk with other cops. This isn't something that necessarily needed to be in a database. And you also did have a national database that could have clued, you know, there could have been some crossover where people could have looked in this database and saw, oh, wow, why is John Gacy's name coming up again and again? And I think that you have police speaking with his victims as if they are suspect. And you have to wonder, you know, when you start seeing, you know, I was able to see a full archive of all the news clips from around that time. And every newsman is standing in front of his house saying, you know, this victim was a drug user. This victim was a homosexual. And that was a way of dismissing these victims. So between those two things where you don't see law enforcement coordinating, even though they hear about this man time and time again, and then you have this dismissal of his victims, when we put two and two together, it was like, wait, this isn't happening because it's, you know, sliding under, you know, the radar. This is happening because it's being ignored.
Well,
it's being Yeah.
There's a lot of pieces of this. And, you know, I've thought about this many, many times. And as many serial killers, I mean, serial killers, if they are not good at their craft, they're not serial killers. They're one and done or two. Gacy was very good at what he did. And he, in my view, you know, chose victims who some of them were runaways. Some of them were people who came from other states, but not all of them. And in fact, the last victim was somebody whose mother was waiting in the parking lot to celebrate her birthday, and he took the kid right out of the store and brought him home and killed him. So, but are we talking about a different era, though? You know, flashback in the late 70s, and this docuseries really brings you back into that era by, you know, all the footage you had of clothing and different. And, you know, people weren't accepting of gay people back then. So do you think that was part of it, that the police just didn't have regard for homosexual boys at the time?
I think that there is an element of that, but I think that a lot of these young men were not homosexual. I think a lot of these young men were simply looking for a job. You have to question, people have asked me, we have the only interview with Gacy's ex-wife, Carol Lofgren. And Carol spent hours with us at a coffee shop talking to us about living in that home and what it was like. And, you know, somebody said to me yesterday, said, you know, she could smell death in the house. Why didn't she go looking in the crawl space? Why didn't she call the police? And I think that you had a lot of different elements going on here. You had people like David Cram and Michael Rossi living in the house. And you had Gacy being this very well-respected kind of political wannabe. And so he had a lot of engagement with the community. There was no reason to think that he was suspect in any way until, you know, things start adding up. And, you know, I've heard, and this, you know, I shouldn't use this type of evidence, but I have heard in the past of, you know, aldermen's kids getting off of crimes because, you know, kind of got split under, or, you know, people were told to look the other way.
The Chicago, that's the Chicago way, or, you know, I think it is the Chicago way.
Yeah. So you're not disagreeing.
No,
and
but
so
I think it's
think about that,
diminishing. I don't think we see that as much anymore, but I certainly think in the 70s and even in the 80s, we saw a lot of that.
And I think that when you look at, you know, in, I think it was 1974, 75, Operation Greylord starts. Because they see the amount of corruption is so overwhelming within the government in Chicago that, you know, they have to send in a national task force. And Operation Greylord, I think, prosecuted over 90 people within the government. Judges, policemen, you know, all sorts of different people. So these are happening at the same time. Gacy is, you know, arrested in 1978, and in 1984, all of these convictions for Operation Greylord go down.
Interesting. And people who have followed the Gacy story may recall that prior to coming to Chicago, I mean, he was born and raised in the Chicago area, but he went to Waterloo, Iowa, and managed some fast food stores, and there was arrested and convicted for some improprieties with minors, and he spent some time in jail there. And while, of course, he's in jail, he's the model prisoner and does everything right and gets out of jail and comes to Chicago and ups the ante. And now instead of just abusing young boys, he's killing them. But that didn't even seem to, you know, tarnish his reputation, did it? From what you've seen.
And I think that from what we were able to put together, you can imagine we were hunkered down on this for 10 straight years. And so basically when we interviewed people in Waterloo, you have this way that Gacy is operating, where he is empowered. The young man that he sodomizes in Waterloo is the son of a state senator.
Right.
And this is a state senator that is part of the JCs with him. So all along, you're seeing this very high-risk behavior where he is engaging in things that most people would never even dare for fear of being caught. But yet he's doing these things over and over again. When you talk about, you know, good behavior, I don't know that he necessarily had good behavior. I know that both in Cook County Jail and in Waterloo, he seemed to have a lot of privilege. When he's down at Menard, he's getting all these privileges. We were able, Craig Bowley, the man who supplied the 1992 interview, he had all of Gacy's logs that showed us what he was eating, what he was drinking, who he was socializing with. And he seems to be able to make money, you know, via his paintings. He's got an 800 number that are, yeah, a number that people can call to pay to talk with him. He's got all of these privileges, and you have to wonder why.
Interesting. We're talking to Tracy Ullman, who is one of the executive producers of Devil in Disguise, which streams on Peacock. Highly recommended. It's a 6-part episode. When we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit more about whether there were more victims where they are and whether there were additional perpetrators to these crimes. You're listening to Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're here talking about the new docuseries, John Wayne Gacy, Devil in Disguise, with one of the executive producers, Tracy Ullman. And Tracy, let's talk about this aspect of the, you know, someone said to me the other day, I saw the docuseries and man, does it raise, it raises more questions than it gives answers, which is really intriguing. And I think one of the questions is, were there more victims? And what is your thought on that, Tracy, given all that you've, time you've spent 10 years researching and talking to people about the issue?
So I put a lot of thought into this, and, you know, we spent 10 years trying to get this commissioned. When it finally ended up with NBC, we had to make several compromises, as you often do in production. Everybody, you know, the team contributes to the final outcome, and some of the things that we wanted to insert into the documentary didn't make it in. I did write these things up in blog posts that I have on my blog, and basically they make a case for there being other victims. Detective from Des Plaines Police, Rafael Tovar, believes there are more victims since Gacy. And with you having had conversations with Gacy, you'd know if Gacy said, I think there are more victims. I think instead of 33, it might be 45. If he's talking that way, he's baiting you.
Right.
You know, right. And so if you think about him, you know, what does that mean? I believe that from some of the police reports that we received, there's one from 1972 where an Ameritech serviceman meets somebody who's a manager of an apartment building that later on in 1994, he says that was Gacy. And Gacy had dug all these trenches in the basement. It smelled like death. He got in a fight with this man because he said, you know, I don't really want to be in this basement. It's starting to spook me out, smells like death. And the man who was the apartment manager confronted him and said, you know, how would you know what that smells like? And he said, I've been in Vietnam. And so you think, okay, this man who's reporting to the police seems to have, you know, fairly good grounding, and tries over and over again to get some leverage to report what he feels are more bodies in this building. By the time they investigate in 1994, the building in Uptown has been plowed under and there's a parking lot over it. You can't see in the report, you know, it's redacted where the location is. But then you also have one of Gacy's former employees, Marty Zielinski, talking about working at the Rainbow Roller Rink and how they were refurbishing a basement, knocking out a wall, and Gacy made this room that was, you know, closet size, large closet. And instead of throwing out detritus, he was putting the detritus in this little room and then sealing it up. And Marty Zielinski goes on to describe how, as they were sealing up this doorway into this room, wondering what was behind it, and also wanting to put his name on it, Marty Zielinski was here. So he's really giving an accurate account of at least his experience. When that building was ultimately knocked down, the Rainbow Roller Rink, they did find bodies. It's reported in the Chicago Tribune. They did find bodies in that foundation. And it's very unclear, you know, these are our bones that are reported in the Chicago Tribune, what the origin of these bones are, or if there's any investigation into them.
And, so, you know, I have always thought, I mean, John Gacy was a construction person, and he had contracts to build certain franchises. And we know that he was in the Pacific Northwest, and he went out of town to different places to build these facilities. And to me, you know, it would be much easier for him to do what he did in these rural areas and to dispose of bodies, as opposed to where he lived, you know, in Norwood Park, where the houses are fairly close together and people know who he was. So, I mean, yes, it seems to me that there are probably victims in the Chicago area. Your docuseries really, really weighs heavily on you when you see that there probably are, and that we haven't gotten to bottom
Miami
of it.
Elston is, you know, prolific in the documentary series, and we were thrilled to see that.
And that's the site of where his mother used to live, and he was seen there again, you know, concreting things and digging things and doing John Gacy things. And again, I don't think we've ever done a full dig there to decide whether or not there are bodies there. And why not? Why couldn't there be a warrant of just getting that small little piece of property jackhammered all the way down to make sure that there are not unidentified victims there?
There's always been the excuse made, you know, we don't want to affect the landlord. We don't want to scare the tenants. If you take a look at the Miami and Elston building, half of those apartments are no longer rented. You can see that the property is just deteriorating. It's a kind of nondescript 1957, five flat. So what are we really talking about here? And for us, myself and Allison, remaining, you know, with this project for 10 years, we both have children. And we thought, what if our children ended up in this lawn? We would want a law enforcement authority to help us find our children. It was really interesting. I got an email the other day after, you know, a recording within the documentary states that Gacy talks to Sam Amaranti, his defense lawyer initially, about an individual that he leaves by Maine East High School. Well, somebody from Des Plaines Police contacted us and said, I remember that missing persons report coming in. That body was found by a young man who was going fishing in that park.
It goes on and on. And and you know, we have so little time, but I just wanted to touch briefly on other perpetrators. Are you of the belief that there were other perpetrators involved in these crimes for which he was convicted?
I realize that neither of the young men that lived with him were ever prosecuted for any crime. So I can't say that I believe that I was not there and I couldn't find any solid evidence. But when you look at police reports, really close daily police reports that Terry Sullivan had in his collection, you can see that the police are desperate to get Michael Rossi and David Cram talking.
Okay, so let me just interrupt. Yeah. Those two individuals were young men who lived with Gacy and who testified at trial that they actually dug the trenches under the crawl space. They claim they didn't know nothing about the bodies, knew nothing about the crimes, but they actually dug the trenches, and they testified against Gacy at the trial. Go ahead.
Correct, yeah. And tell me if I get long-winded.
No, it's okay. We got like 1 minute, Tracy, so I'm going to have to.
They testify at trial, but they do not speak to the fact that in police records, they've already admitted to having a sexual relationship with John Gacy. They admit during, their trial that they have dug these trenches, and it would be almost impossible for them not to know what else was down in that crawl space. I think the bigger issue is that Michael Rossi is still living, and it would be great to have some answers from him from his anecdotal experience.
It sure would. Tracy Ullman, thank you so much for joining us. Please, I urge you to watch it. It's on Peacock. It streams. There's 6 episodes. John Wayne Gacy, Devil in Disguise. Congratulations on a really well-done, very thoughtful documentary. Tracy, good luck to you, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, Karen. It was great talking to you.